The four pre-dark war wags rolled along the edge of the cliff. Oddly, the dust cloud located where the Outlanders had been was thicker than ever, the grayish white of the salty sand rapidly becoming an impenetrable brown.
I don't like this. Full stop!
And hit the headlights!
Cotton looked suspiciously through the windshield. Between the airborne salt and smoke, it was impossible to see a thing in the night. Visibility was less than 20 paces.
Sure thing, Chief.
Instantly, four sets of brilliant beams stabbed out into the thickening fumes. There were only vague shapes shifting in the dark cloud. Then flames rose high, adding a bright halo of illumination that silhouetted the Big Mac rig and wooden flatbed.
Holy nuke in hell! Ha! Ha! Their wagon is on fire! No chance of the bastards getting away now!
Muty shit! It's a trick!
Cotton grabbed the mic from the ceiling.
All wags, triple red, this is an ambush! Repeat, this is an
Suddenly, the LAV-25 to their left violently detonated, a staggering fireball expanding from within. As his wag was buffeted by the concussion, Delphi suddenly realized what had happened. Ryan and the others couldn't run or hide, so they'd set their own wag on fire to create a protective smoke screen in order to ambush the convoy. The plan was audacious, almost insane, but it had worked, and in a single instant, the cyborg had lost a quarter of his fighting forces.
Open fire!
The two miniguns on the roof cut loose, as did the flamethrower, the column of fire licking across the landscape in hellish fury. Suddenly, the burning wooden wag lurched into motion and charged forward to ram into an LAV-25. The lightweight metal and chrome did no damage to the heavy steel alloy armor of the pre-dark war machine, but the big diesel engine surged with power, the burning tires dug into the loose soil, and the Mac began forcing the LAV sideways, heading directly for the cliff.
Kill the driver!
Delphi pulled out his crystal wand and pointed it at the flame-enshrouded cab. But there was nobody in sight behind the wheel.
The bastards have rigged it somehow!
Outside, black smoke gushing from the louvered exhaust ports, the LAV lurched into action, trying to angle away from the ragged cliff. But the smashed chassis of the Mac was tangled on the armor frame of the LAV, and the battling machines began to curve into the dense cloud and out of sight.
Harrison, shoot the Outlander wag with your cannon! Blast yourself free!
Jody, please! I can get us free!
Harrison, that was an order! Use the fucking cannon!
I'm not gonna wait for it or allow you to get out!
As Delphi switched his eyes to the ultraviolet spectrum, the cloud dramatically thinned, and he clearly saw the struggling LAV and Mack truck go over the edge.
Ah! Harrison, talk to me!
It's too late.
Stunned beyond words, Delphi could only stare at the empty section of cliff. It was incredible. Ryan and his people had taken out two of his armored personnel carriers in only a few minutes. Just for a second, the cyborg tasted fear. Then he shrugged off the useless emotion. This was it. Killing time. No more finesse or clever plans, just bare-knuckle bloodletting. Get clear of the smoke, establish a new fire base, lay down suppression fire, frack at the targets, then kill them all. Delphi raised the mic to his mouth.
Retreat at full speed! Don't turn around! Just move!
Get the fuck out of this cloud, people, or we're shit in a can!
The military wag moved swiftly away from the murky cliff. Suddenly, something bounced off the windshield. A thin crack appeared in the pre-dark plastic, and bitter smoke began to seep into the control room.
Down!
Grabbing Cotton, Delphi hauled the sec woman to the floor as two more grunts hit the windshield. A million jagged pieces of the shattered windshield blew into the vehicle, cutting the driver to shreds. Delphi and Cotton crawled along the short passage out of the control room and to the rear cargo area. There were four other troopers standing near the exit hatch, with rifles in their hands, unsure of what to do. Still in gear, the LAV continued to roll along backward, without direction. Strapped into position, the side gunners hung limply in their chairs, red blood dripping from their tattered clothing, shards of windshield sparkling from the countless small cuts covering their gory bodies.
Grab whatever you can, boys!
Cotton took a mixed bag of ammo and grants from a peg on the wall.
Fuckers screwed the Muty when they tangled with us.
There was a trickle of warmth on Cotton's cheek, but the sec woman stoically ignored the minor wound. The men started to fill their pockets with brass and grins.
Stay low, and only shoot when you clearly see the Outlanders. I don't want any of my people chilled by friendly fire.
Actually, Delphi didn't give a damn if they died. He just didn't want them getting in the way when he went after Ryan and Tanner. When this was over, he was going to kill everybody anyway. Delphi yanked a panel off the wall, exposing a series of glowing buttons.
Ready?
Rock and roll, Chief!
A section slid aside to reveal sandy ground streaming past the opening. Without a pause, the cyborg dropped through to hit the dirt and go flat. A moment later, Cotton dropped from the LAV, followed by five others in tight formation. Salty dust filled the air, and it was hard to see clearly, but a moment later, the shadow of the LAV-25 was gone. Suddenly, they were bathed in bright halogen headlights. Frantically, Delphi and Cotton dived to the side, but the others moved too slowly. Listening hard for any sound of the hated Outlanders, Delphi watched the LAV-25 veer off randomly. The rear hoisted upward, and the wheels left the ground. Stuck in place, the front wheels started to dig down into the crystalline soil, throwing more salt and sand into the air. Delphi saw the cliff had collapsed completely to form a sort of rough steps leading down to the polluted lake. It was an avenue of escape, if necessary. The situation was quickly getting out of his control, and a wise man knew when it was time to go. Not yet, however. He still had a lot of killing to do first. One of his surviving men flinched and grabbed his throat. A leaf-shaped throwing blade was buried to the hilt in the side of his neck. Delphi calculated the angle of trajectory from which the blade had come, then pointed his crystal rod in that direction. If he hit anybody, there was no way to tell. The convoy had had four armored vehicles to Ryan's old piece of homemade junk, and yet the Outlanders were winning. It was impossible. The cyborg scowled. He should have been traveling with 100 hunter droids, instead of leaving them to guard the redoubt. Delphi instantly raised his force shield. The cyborg replied with a needler and laser. He then realized that the bright energy beam was how they were finding him. Reluctantly, he sheathed the rod and flexed his hand to activate the malfunctioning educator. He moved it in a slow arc, blindly trying for a kill, as a Gren came falling from above. The hot shrapnel completely failed to penetrate his shield.
Here I am, Tanner! Come and get me!
Murky figures moved toward the trapped wag. Cotton pulled out the sawed-off 12-gauge and started forward grimly. The smoky cloud was starting to thin, and she scowled at the unexpected sight of two men on horseback riding toward the fight. For a moment, Cotton thought they might be cold hearts, but then she saw that their clothing matched and that they were packing rapid fires. They had to be Sekhmen. There wasn't a bill around for 100 miles. But it didn't really matter. If they weren't her men, they had to be killed. Staying low, Cotton tried to get a bead on the newcomers when something metallic came into view trailing after the two big men.
Nuking hell!
It was a Predark machine of some sort. The large, cylindrical body was made of shiny steel, and there were armored treads underneath, rocketing the thing forward almost as fast as a horse could run, which meant it was a lot quicker than any person on foot. There was a smooth dome on top, bristling with antennae, and the thing sported two crazy red eyes that spun around in every direction. Flexing metal arms extended from the sides, each of them tipped with spinning buzzsaws.
A Sekhunter droid!
Delphi fired the HK needler and the laser at the war machine. The sizzling red beam struck the droid and seemed to be absorbed, but the stainless steel flechettes bounced off wildly, some of them coming back to impact the cyborg's shield. Just then, the two riders on horseback galloped past the cyborg, firing M16 assault rifles at point-blank range. But the 5.56mm hardball rounds rebounded harmlessly from his force field. He aimed the rod at one rider, the needler at the other. One of them was hit in the arm with his laser, the other with the needler, before they vanished into the billowing cloud.
How bizarre. One of them resembled Edward Rogan. But that's impossible. The Rogan brothers were chilled and buried long ago.
Quickly, the cyborg set the laser to full power, minimum aperture, and swept the battlefield, trying for a quick kill. Instantly, incoming lead and steel pounded his shield from several directions, and another rain of grens was augmented by a large homemade pipe bomb. The combined detonation rocked the cyborg, almost making him fall. Then inspiration hit, and Delphi reached out with his EM implants to seize control of the droid and turn it against the Outlanders. But try as he might, there was no answering signal from the droid. It spun around and charged, coming directly for him as it locked onto his broadcast. Standing his ground, Delphi stabbed out with a laser and needler. The dual weapons savaged the droid, removing an arm and melting an eye. But the machine kept coming.
The metal thing is after the Jeep! Chill the fucker!
A hail of hot lead hit the chrome dome, doing scant damage. Then the machine saw one of the men. The twin saw swung in opposite directions. Blood sprayed high as the man fell to the ground in ragged pieces.
The fucker killed Jimmy! Light it up!
The 20-millimeter Vulcan swiveled on top of the remaining war wag. Nimbly, the droid dodged to the side, then grabbed the Predark APC in a deadly hug. Sparks flew like fireworks as the spinning blades dug into the steel armor. Withdrawing the blades, the droid wrapped its arms around the barrel of the Vulcan minigun. The droid tossed the minigun away and focused on the unfortunate operator. Lurching into action at the ghastly sight, Cotton sprinted back to the LAV they had abandoned, which was trapped against the dune. Clambering inside, she activated the flamethrower, aiming the blazing column of jelly fuel at the Sec Hunter droid. Covered in flames, the droid reached out to grab the fluted nozzle and crush it tight. The seals blew on the flamethrower, and the interior of the WAG was flooded with burning chems. Then, the fuel tanks ignited. The explosions also ripped the droid apart, the sparkling debris flying through the cloudy air. A horse ran past Delphi without a rider, and the cyborg knew the two newcomers were now on foot. Trying to lure them close, he trained the educator on a galloping horse. Some long plastic tubes were sticking out of the fallen horse's saddlebags, breaking apart and spilling out pieces of pre-dark rockets. Delphi saw the animal go limp as drops of red blood started to bead its hide.
See that, Tanner? You're next, old man, and then I'll go back in time to fuck your wife!
Either Doc Tanner had not heard the threat, or he didn't believe it, which was much more likely. A blind fury boiled within the cyborg.
My men are dead! My LAVs are destroyed! It's time to end this!
Expanding his force field to the maximum range, Delphi moved relentlessly through the swirling fumes. Keeping a slab of broken plank in front as a shield, Ryan stayed low and aimed his Kalashnikov at the small area of clean air that moved within the swirling, acrid fumes of the burning wagon tires. The force field that protected the cyborg also made him easy to spot. The companion's plan had been to try to lure Delphi to the cliff and throw him into the lake. Doc had said that his force field stopped working when it got wet. But the cyborg was crafty and was keeping as far away from the crumbling edge as possible. Ryan found the clip empty and tossed the rapid fire away. That had been the last reload. Now he was down to the Steyr, the Sig Sauer, a few Grens, and the Ponga. The heated barrage of rounds told him that somebody had more ammo for their BAR, and Ryan stayed low as he moved across the sandy ground. His eye was stinging badly from the airborne salt, but there was nothing he could do about it but ignore the pain. Pieces of smoldering metal and steaming chunks of bodies lay everywhere, spent brass lying golden among the silvery grains of salt and sand. A brief stutter of flame pinpointed the location of JB in the smoke. A red beam lanced across the battleground toward the armorer, and he ducked, barely in time. Breaking into a full run, Ryan pulled out the Ponga.
Come on, Phoebe. Use that laser one more time.
Suddenly, a dark shape rose from behind a dead horse, and steel flashed mirror bright as a trooper stabbed at Ryan with his bayonet. The bayonet knocked the Steyr aside, and Ryan swung the Ponga. The trooper's lifeless body dropped to the ground. Then a lambent energy beam stabbed out of the roiling smoke. It shot past Ryan, and the dead man's clothing burst into flames. Ryan jerked aside to throw a Gren. It vanished into the gloom. Encouraged by Delphi's cry, Ryan prepared another Gren and started forward, the Steyr leading the way. In the haze, Delphi struggled to his feet, just in time to see a giant charge out of the smoke. He recognized Edward Rogan and immediately brought up the needler. But as Rogan's body collapsed to the ground, Delphi saw a lit fuse dangling from the canvas satchel strapped to his back, along with the clearly printed words, U.S. Army, C-4, plastic explosive, demolition charge.
No!
He turned to run. Suddenly airborne, Delphi fell through the moonlight, then crashed onto the pebbled beach. Thankfully, his protective force field was as strong as ever. He climbed to his feet. He had missed landing in the scummy water by less than a foot. Glancing upward, Delphi saw Ryan and the companion standing on the cliff above. Then a hail of dark objects flashed past the cyborg.
You missed me!
Delphi raised the crystal rod to kill his adversaries when the barrage of grens and pipe bombs detonated. A foamy wave of dirty water washed over Delphi. Erupting into sparks, the force field visibly wavered and then vanished. The cyborg looked down in horror at his dripping wet hands, then quickly aimed the laser. Pain tore through Delphi, and his internal systems went into emergency function, closing off arteries and rerouting blood as microfilaments raced to close the gaping wounds in his chest and limbs. More grens flew overhead and hit the lake. The explosion soaked Delphi again and again. He stumbled away, bleeding, unsure of where to go or what to do next. A pipe bomb landed nearby. He kicked it away to bounce off a boulder and disappear into the thick green scum. The blast sent a column of steam and slime skyward, but as he dodged the falling hail of hot filth, his strength returned with every beat of his artificial heart. The blood had stopped gushing from the bullet wounds, and his vision was clear once more. Breaking into a run, the cyborg pelted along the pebble beach, thinking only of escape. Bullets kicked up the stones along the shoreline, ricochets throwing out sparks as more grens hit the lake. Only a faint spray reached Delphi, moistening his tattered clothing, washing away the red blood, tinged with hints of yellow. His force field fluttered in response, struggling to come back online. Just a few more seconds, and he would be safe.
Yes! Almost there!
Then something large fell from the sky, and Delphi instinctively tried to gain as much precious distance from it as possible. The thing hit the beach, and he saw it was another satchel charge.
Ha! The fools missed the lake entirely!
Then the awful truth hit Delphi. The satchel charge had been exactly on target.
No!
Chaos ruled Delphi's mind as he was blown sideways toward the lake. The cyborg sank to the bottom as his struggling force field dropped completely. But the depth was only a few yards. He still had a fighting chance. Struggling to hold his breath, Delphi clawed for purchase on the smooth pebbles lining the shallow water, grabbing hold of something round and full of holes. Panicking at the thought of another gren, the cyborg illuminated his eyes and stared in mindless terror at the charred skull. There was just enough tattered flesh left for him to identify Edward Rogan, the teeth grinning evilly in the dappled water. Then it hit him. Teeth in the water. Releasing the horrid thing, Delphi surged upward. Brushing away the sodden hair from his face, the cyborg couldn't see anybody nearby. Lying on the shore were more pieces of Rogan, a boot with a foot inside, a bent machete, and a gun belt, with an undamaged Webley still firmly in the holster. Racing toward the beach, Delphi almost made it out of the water. Jerking toward the collapsed section of the cliff, Delphi saw two men riding a horse across the loose soil. Ryan and Tanner. The cyborg grinned in delight. Now he could kill the fools and take their horse for his escape. Raising his hand, Delphi aimed the educator. A hole gaped in the cyborg's palm. There was a sniper overhead. Staggering away from the shore, Delphi tried to raise his force field to no avail. Suddenly, something tightened around his leg.
What?
Looking down, he saw a slimy tentacle extending out of sight under the scummy water. Other tentacles were wiggling along the bottom to haul away the scattered bits of Rogan. The fresh blood had attracted the attention of an underwater scavenger. Glancing at the Webley only yards away, Delphi attempted to break free of the undulating limb. The creature's grip was like iron. Delphi thrust his damaged hand into the water. He hoped the short circuit might drive the mutie away, but the tentacle only tightened more, nearly crushing his leg. Inexorably, it began to pull him away from the shore and deeper into the toxic chem lake. Reining in the wounded horse, Ryan and Doc jumped to the ground and advanced upon the cyborg. Hydraulic fluid and blood seeped from the wounds, staining the lake with mottled colors.
Wait! Save me! And I'll tell you the secrets of the redoubt! I know it all! I know everything!
With his enhanced vision, the cyborg saw that the creature seemed to be composed of nothing but tentacles and a large, sloppy mouth that opened and closed constantly. Madness overwhelmed him as his laboring lungs began to throb with the need for air. Then his internal systems came online, and flapping gills opened in his neck, bringing new strength with a rush of oxygen. Redoubling his efforts to escape, Delphi slashed at the tentacle. Incredibly, the ropey limb withdrew, only to be replaced by a dozen more tentacles that wrapped tightly around his arms and legs, pinning the cyborg helpless. As if it were some ancient kraken from pre-dark myths, the aquatic mutie dragged the squirming Delphi into the shadowy depths of the lake and stuffed him whole into its gaping mouth. Delphi thrashed madly as a thousand tiny fangs pierced his flesh and hardened gums began to slowly grind, ripping away layer after layer of clothing, skin, and muscle. Pain filled his world. Still alive and horribly conscious, Delphi began traveling down the putrid gullet as searing stomach acids washed over his helpless form.
And so ends Delphi. I would have preferred to take his life personally, but nothing is perfect.
Near enough.
Ryan slid the stire off his shoulder. Patiently, he waited for the cyborg to rise again from the scummy waves. There was no movement.
Satisfied, my dear Ryan?
Near enough.
The two men turned, grabbing for their weapons, but it was only the rest of the companions. Everybody seemed undamaged, except for Chief Sterling, who had his bloody arm stuffed into his shirt for support.
That pays a lot of debts. Never thought I'd see the day. When Rogan and I found that fucking droid in a cache of pre-dark blasters, I thought I was on the last train west for sure. Then the nuking thing gave a bow like we were barons and asked for orders.
So you told it to come along and help Ace Delphi?
Yep. Worked, too, although damned if I know why.
How you find?
Doomy told us back in Tucson.
Thank Gaia for that.
Yeah, good thing Doomies are on our side. Be a triple bitch to fight an enemy who knew what you were gonna do even before you did.
Got that right.
Sterling rubbed his arm.
I can fix that.
Mildred reached into her med kit.
It'll only take a few minutes.
Sounds good. It's gonna be a long walk back to Tucson without horses or wags.
First, we have to wreck that island.
Ryan walked to the edge of the beach. Now that Delphi was gone, he couldn't take his sight off the place. He was almost there. Ryan noted that down here he could even see the white adobe building with a strange design above the doorway. And now he knew what the symbol stood for.
Get ready, Titan. Here I come.
Suddenly, there was a flash of bright light and a moment of disorientation. As his vision cleared, Ryan blinked at the sight of snow covering the landscape. Reaching all the way to the craggy black mountains on the horizon, the snow-capped peaks and tors, challenging the heavens above. The sun was high overhead, and a shaggy goat stood on a nearby rocky pinnacle, chewing on some flowery weeds growing out of a small crevice.
Fire blast!
Hastily looking around, he was relieved to find the rest of the companions standing waist-deep in snow, only a few yards away from the towering black doors of a redoubt.
Dark night! What the fuck just happened?
JB removed his fedora to brush back his hair.
Must have been Titan's defense mechanism. Mighty nice of them to send us here rather than the moon.
Where are we? Alaska?
Tell you in a sec.
JB tugged the mini-sextant out from under his sandy shirt.
More important, where is Chief Sterling?
Probably back at Tucsonville. And I strongly suggest that we get our damp asses out of the cold before we all catch pneumonia and die.
Well, I only see one place to go.
Christy walked to the keypad.
Okay, this is Siberia. Yep. We're smack in the middle of fucking Siberia, about 1,000 miles from Moscow.
You sure about that? Why would there be a redoubt here?
Who knows? We've been in redoubts outside Deathlands before. Who knows why any of them are built?
Siberia? The other side of the world? You know, to anybody with brains, this would be seen as a warning to never trouble the folks on that island again.
Yeah, I guess so. Last time they sent me back to the trader. This time halfway around the globe. Brass will get you powder that the next time we'll be dead. Chilled to the bone.
So the next time we get them first, smash the island to shit before getting close. We'll figure out something.
The companions hurried into the redoubt's access tunnel. Doc looked out the door at the distant Russian mountains, lost in somber contemplation. Court Strasser was dead, as was Silas, and now Delphi. When would enough blood be spilled to pay his debt to the universe? When would sufficient evil lives be lost to redress the balance?
When will I be allowed to go home?
Doc turned away from the barren wasteland and looked towards his friends, the only real family he had anymore. Back in Tucsonville, Edgar Franklin leaned against a low cinder block wall with a warm beer, watching the workmen toil in the Bill's greenhouses. Safe behind the wall of glass, the thriving green plant seemed almost unnatural, set amid the endless desolation that surrounded the walled city. In spite of himself, the cyborg was mildly amused. Not even the legendary Dante ever imagined a lush garden in the center of hell.
Ah.
Franklin set the mug of beer aside and started toward his room in the basement of the gaudy house. Thankfully, everything had gone according to plan, and the grand scheme of things was finally back on schedule. He had completed his assigned task, and Delphi was dead. In the morning, he was supposed to meet the Baron, but instead, he would slip out of the villa at dawn and return to the redoubt, then jump back to his base and resume his regular duties. The traitor had been destroyed, but Titan's bid for control of the Deathlands had only just begun. Deathlands Desert Kings is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2008, Worldwide Library. All rights reserved. Deathlands and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Tim Carlin, Andy Clements, James Konacek, Karen Carbone, James Lewis, Eric Messner, Lily Beacon, Johan Detweiler, Nathaniel Perry, and Mort Shelby. Additional redshirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johan Detweiler. Additional original music by Johan Detweiler. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Book adapted for graphic audio by Joshua Cristiano. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders, available at roadstops everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for another gear-grinding episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator.
Graphic Audio presents... Mark Dalton, owner-operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belkin. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belkin. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Player. Episode number 5, Reefer Madness.
After Mark Dalton delivered his load of bottled water to a food service distributor in Winnipeg, he considered giving his ex-wife a call to find out how she was making out on her ride back to Toronto with Mick, the toothless truck driver. But as his thumb swept across the keypad of his cell phone in search of the on button, he imagined her screaming at him about how he'd left her all alone at the mercy of a grimy man with more fingers than teeth. That kind of abuse he could do without. Besides, after he called her, he'd have to speak to his dispatcher, Bud. And when it came right down to it, he had finite capacity for abuse. And if he was going to endure it, he might as well get it from Bud.
Yellow!
Hey, Bud, it's Mark.
Mark who?
Mark McGuire.
Sorry, pal, I don't know any Mark McGuire.
For crying out loud, Bud, it's me, Mark Dalton.
Oh, Mark Dalton. Hey, what's wrong with your cell phone?
Nothing, why?
I've been getting calls from your ex-wife every half hour.
Yeah?
From what I can tell between the screaming, she's pretty pissed with you. Says a guy named Mick keeps giving her the creepy eye.
Huh. Well, sucks to be her, I guess.
Yeah. But what do you want?
Oh, how about, I don't know, a load?
Ah, the pickings are slim at the moment, my friend.
You must have something.
Well, what do you know about reefers?
They're great icebreakers at parties.
I'm serious here.
Okay, I don't know anything about reefers.
I never stopped you from taking a special load before. Well, these guys seem desperate for drivers, paying 30% over the usual fee for this sort of load.
Why are they being so generous? Does it have anything to do with mad cow disease?
I don't know.
30%? They still can't get drivers?
They said they needed dependable drivers they know can get the load to its destination no matter what. When I heard that, well, I naturally thought of you.
Naturally.
So you want to take the load or not?
Sure, why not?
Bud gave him the details. The company was named Better Beef and was based in Regina, Saskatchewan. He'd have to bobtail it there, then take on a chassis and reefer container filled with frozen beef, headed for Vancouver and ultimately Japan. Mark got off the phone and headed for Regina. After stopping for the night outside of Wolseley, Saskatchewan, Mark was able to easily make it into Regina for his 8 a.m. appointment at the Better Beef loading dock. As he made the turn off of Lawrence Street into the Better Beef Yard, he noticed that directly across the street was a markedly newer operation called Best Beef. The building looked as if it had been recently constructed, and every truck and trailer in the yard was a late model, painted in gloss black with the Best Beef logo on it and the company name in bright yellow 10-foot-high letters down the side of the trailer. It was an impressive-looking operation, and their trucks had to be the envy of most of the drivers in the province. Looking at Best Beef, it was no wonder Better Beef was having trouble finding drivers. Best Beef had set up shop across the street to steal the business away from Better Beef by paying the best rates and offering the best benefit packages in the industry. It was a good strategy in the short term, but if Better Beef held on long enough, the new operation might stretch itself too thin to continue without filing for bankruptcy protection. Mark only hoped that if it was Better Beef that went under, they held on long enough for his paycheck to clear. It took 10 minutes to find the shipper's office, but when he did, the large man behind the desk named Voyek seemed thrilled to see him.
Are you the Mark Dalton?
Yeah, as far as I know, I'm the only one.
Good, good, come in.
You have a load for me?
Yes, I have a load. As many as you want.
Just one would be fine for today.
Voyek nodded.
One today, one next week, one next month.
Why are you having so much trouble getting drivers?
Well, driver is responsible for load. Well,
that's not different than a lot of other loads. Besides, you guys have insurance, right?
Of course.
So what's the problem?
A reefer load is different. It takes extra work from the driver, and how much work depends on the condition of the reefer container.
Mark looked out the window at the containers lined up in the yard. They weren't brand new like the reefers over at Best Beef, but they didn't look all that run down either. The oldest container in the yard couldn't be more than 5 years old.
You've got some pretty good equipment out there. Breakdowns shouldn't be a problem.
Not all drivers are like you, Mr. Dalton. They don't want to take chances on load.
But the money you're paying is good, right?
There had to be a catch here, somewhere. Voyek outlined the company's pay rates, and they were just as Bud had explained to him over the phone.
Well, I guess I'll be taking a chance on a load.
Excellent!
Voyek led Mark out onto the loading dock, where workers were packing frozen meat into the rear of the reefer container backed up to the loading dock.
How much do you know about reefers?
I know they're fun at parties.
Okay, well, anyway.
Voyek began explaining the setup and operation of the reefer container, from checking the oil to inspecting the belts, from the basic operation of the control system to the procedure for defrosting the coil. After a half-hour crash course in reefer operation, Mark's head was spinning. It all seemed straightforward enough, but there was a lot of information to assimilate at one time. He hoped he could remember it all, but a greater hope was that nothing would go wrong with the reefer on this trip.
Now, if unit shuts down completely...
Why would it shut down completely?
It shouldn't, but you never know.
Mark was dubious, but he supposed it was best to cover all the bases.
Okay.
If unit shuts down completely, this time of year you got about 2 hours, maybe three, before the outside heat starts to affect load.
What happens after 2 hours?
Then the outside of the load could start defrost and you get damage.
Mark nodded.
That happens, you call me, and I send a man to fix it.
Woyek handed Mark his business card.
But it's a pretty new reefer unit, right? It should be fine.
Yes, should be fine.
Minutes later, they finished loading up the reefer. The temperature was set at minus 40. The seal was put on the container, and Mark was given all the papers he would need to connect with the yard manager on the docks in Vancouver. By 11 that morning, he was back on the road, confident that everything would be fine. After all, the reefer was humming away behind him like a long hauler, the load was frozen solid, and it was an easy run into the port of Vancouver. What could go wrong? But as he ran Motherload up through the gears, he noticed a long black Best Beef truck pulling onto the highway behind him.
Huh. Wonder if he's headed to the coast, too.
By the middle of the afternoon, Mark had reached Swift Current, Saskatchewan, home of junior hockey's Broncos. After missing out on lunch, Mark's stomach was telling him that it might be a good time to stop for a bite to eat. So he pulled off the Trans-Canada into the first greasy spoon he saw that had a lot big enough for trucks. After shutting down Motherload, Mark did an inspection of the reefer, checking the inside temperature against the set point, which were within a half a degree of each other, and the amount of fuel in the reefer tank, just over three-quarters full. When he was sure everything was running fine, he headed off to the restaurant for lunch. Mark ordered a chicken sandwich and fries and washed it all down with a hot cup of coffee. But instead of heading back to his truck right away, Mark hung around the restaurant, waiting to see if he might need a visit to the bathroom before getting back into his truck for 6 more hours. Turns out he did, and when he emerged from the bathroom 10 minutes later, he felt lighter, refreshed, and ready to hit the road. As he exited the restaurant, Mark could hear his reefer unit humming from across the parking lot. The diesel engine on the chassis was running smoothly and everything seemed to be fine. Until he got a little closer. While the diesel engine was still going, all of the temperature controls were off.
How could that be?
Mark glanced at his watch and figured he hadn't been in the restaurant for more than 30 minutes. Of course, something could go wrong with a computerized control system in a matter of seconds, but something told Mark that this wasn't a simple mechanical or computer error. A quick inspection of the controls proved him right. The controls were off because they'd been turned off. Mark didn't understand. He'd heard of drivers switching off other drivers' reefer diesels at night to cut out the noise so they could get some sleep. But why would someone want to shut off the controls?
What the hell's the benefit of that?
Mark didn't have an answer. So instead of dwelling on the matter, Mark simply turned the controls back on and dialed the set point in at minus 40. The interior temperature read minus 32, which meant the load was still frozen solid, but had lost 8 full degrees in half an hour. That change in temperature had happened a lot faster than Voyek had told him it would, which meant that in the event of a shutdown, Mark would have more like an hour and a half before the load began to spoil. That was good to know, especially since Mark had a feeling there might be more things going wrong with the Reaper on this trip. He watched the interior temperature gauge slowly begin to count down to minus 40. And when he was sure it was going to reach the set point, he decided to head back onto the highway. He climbed up into the driver's seat of Motherlode.
Just my luck.
Or was it? In the lower left corner of his outside mirror, Mark noticed a long black rig parked off in the opposite corner of the lot. The big yellow Best Beat letters on the side of the trailer were unmistakable.
Wonder if he's having as much trouble with his equipment as I am. Maybe I'll ask him if I see him.
A few moments later, after making himself comfortable, Mark put Motherlode into gear and headed for the highway. Behind him, the Best Beef rig got back onto the highway as well. Mark reached the outskirts of Calgary by dark. Usually, whenever he drove through Alberta, he made sure to stop at a steakhouse for an inch-thick T-bone. But his experience at lunch made him wary of an extended meal away from the truck. Instead, he opted for a cup of coffee and an apple fritter, saving any full meal he might have for the morning and daylight. The lot at the truck stop was big, easily accommodating 100 trucks or more. But as much room as there was, Mark wasn't about to take any chances. He drove to the farthest corner of the lot and parked his rig next to a stand of trees. That way, he'd be far enough away not to bother anyone, and the nearby trees would act as a sound cushion, absorbing some of the noise before it could bounce back and make its way across the lot, disturbing all the sleeping drivers. When he had Motherlode in just the right spot, Mark inspected the reefer to make sure everything was running smoothly. He still had more than a half a tank of fuel for the reefer, but the interior temperature was off by 2 degrees at minus 38. It wasn't much of a difference, but because the night was going to be a warm one, he decided to defrost the coil so the refrigeration unit could work at peak efficiency through the night. The coil took less than 20 minutes to defrost, and when he switched the unit back on, it immediately began working to get the interior temperature down to the set point of minus 40.
Now we're talking.
In the morning, he'd order a breakfast to go, top up all his fuel tanks, and he'd be back on the road along with the sun. Mark awoke to the sound of silence. Not silence exactly, but silence accentuated by the peaceful sounds of birds chirping and the distant noises coming from vehicles rolling down the highway across the lot and on the other side of the truck stop.
Oh, man, it sure is peaceful. Nice and quiet. Wait, quiet? Oh, shit!
Mark scrambled out of his sleeper and nearly tumbled out of his truck in a rush to get outside. A quick check of the trailer revealed that the Reaper unit wasn't on, neither the controls nor the generator, nothing. It was as if it had all been shut down, especially since there was more than enough fuel left in the tank for continued operation. Mark took a look around and saw that the lot had filled up during the night, and there was a box trailer pulled by a Kenworth parked right next to him, not more than 10 feet away. Obviously, the driver of that rig had shut down the unit last night so the noise from the thing wouldn't disturb his sleep. Mark went over to the truck.
Come on out of there, you son of a bitch! I know you're in there, and I know what you did, too!
Slowly, the Kenworth began to rock back and forth, and seconds later, there was someone looking down out of the cab at Mark.
You shut off my reefer!
The man slowly got out of the truck, his movements hampered by the veil of sleep that still hung over him.
Did you bastard?
The man turned to face Mark, and Mark knew he could have been a bit more cautious in his dealings with unknown truckers. The man had to be 6'5", 250 pounds. He wore a tank top that showed off the tattoos down the length of each of his arms. His hair was cropped short on top, but was long in the back with one of the worst mullets Mark had ever seen. There were rings in and around both of his ears and on each of his hands, and his boots were tipped with what looked to be chrome steel spikes. The buckle on his belt suggested the man's name was Vernon.
What's your problem, man?
Vernon stepped forward and cast a shadow upon Mark.
My reefer, it's off.
I know. I parked here around 3 in the morning, hoping the sound of the engine would help me sleep. It did for a while, but I woke up when you shut it off around 5.
I didn't shut it off.
Well, somebody did.
And that somebody wasn't you?
Vernon just looked at him.
Well, thanks.
I sit on it and twirl Barbara.
Vernon sneered at Mark, then climbed back into his truck. Mark looked around for another possible suspect and considered banging on the door of another truck, but he didn't want to push his luck. Besides, it didn't matter who had shut him down. What mattered now was starting it up again and getting the temperature back to the set point. Mark went through the steps just like he'd done before, and the reefer unit responded perfectly.
Nothing wrong with the unit.
And luckily, the interior temperature wasn't off by more than 10 degrees. Another disaster averted. Mark headed for the restaurant, wondering why, if he had to be so lucky, all that luck had to be bad. The restaurant was just about like every other greasy spoon he'd ever eaten in, offering a breakfast special of 2 eggs, bacon or sausage, hash browns, and a coffee for less than $5. Mark ordered sausages, scrambled eggs, and asked that the hash browns be replaced by toast, on account of his heart was only being able to handle so much grease at one sitting. Mark found an empty table by a window and turned the chairs around so he could watch his truck while he ate, just in case. Breakfast arrived a few minutes later, and Mark dug into what was a fairly tasty breakfast as far as roadside fare is concerned. After finishing off his eggs, Mark started in on the sausages. Before he had his first bite, an old-timer came up beside him and smiled at him with a sort of goofy grin.
Can I help you?
The old man, wearing a Rough Riders ball cap and a t-shirt from some wheat collective, just smiled at him.
You're driving for better beef, eh?
Yeah.
You crazy or stupid?
Mark pulled back slightly at that, looking the man square in the eyes. What the hell kind of question was that, he wondered. But the longer he looked at the man, the more the man kept smiling. Obviously, the question wasn't meant to be an insult, but perhaps a good-natured jab. Mark decided to humor the man.
A bit of both, I guess.
Yeah, you'd have to be a bit of both to drive for them guys.
Why? What's wrong with better beef?
With better beef? Nothing. It's them other ones you gotta worry about.
Mark was having trouble following the old man, like he was talking in riddles. The old-timer looked like he was about to be on his way, but there was a lot Mark wanted to know before he let the guy slip through his fingers.
Hey, you hungry? I'd be happy to buy you breakfast if I could ask you a couple of questions.
Sure.
Have a seat, then. Tell me what you know about better beef.
The old man slid into the seat across from Mark, still allowing Mark a partial view of his truck over the guy's shoulder. Mark quickly ordered another breakfast, and the old man began eating without missing a beat.
Better Beef's a good company. An excellent company. Been around for ages, and their meat's some of the best you'd ever want to eat. But they're having a real old-fashioned range war with Best Beef. Now, Best opened a shop across the road from Better about a year ago. And they've got all kinds of money, but their product ain't so good. So, instead of working to make themselves better, they've been trying to make better beef worse.
So the two companies are having a big fight, huh?
And this ain't no Pepsi Challenge kind of war, either. This one's a knockdown, drag-em-out kind of brawl.
Mark was silent, wondering just what he'd gotten himself into.
You have trouble with your reefer?
Yeah.
And it's a spanking brand new one, too, right?
Yeah.
And you probably had a Best Beef truck following you west all the way from Regina. That right?
Yeah. But how'd you know?
How do you think? I was hauling a load for them, about 3 months ago. New reefer. Great pay. Everything perfect about the whole deal. Except by the time I'd reached the coast, I'd had so many problems that half the load got turned back for hamburger meat and dog food.
So all of the stuff that's been happening to me...
has happened to just about every other poor slob who's been crazy or stupid enough to take a load from Better Beef.
But that means...
sabotage.
You've gotta be kidding.
Nope. Let's just say that Best Beef doesn't exactly do much of a background check on their drivers. In fact, a criminal record is probably a bonus as far as they're concerned.
Mark could feel his hair start to bristle down the back of his neck at the thought of some thug using him and Motherlode to put a legitimate company out of business. What made it even worse was that there were good-paying loads just waiting there for truckers to pick them up and haul them away. But they were turning them all down out of fear over what somebody might do to them, their truck, and their livelihood.
Damn it.
Drivers had enough trouble making a decent living these days without worrying about their next load possibly being their last.
Well, that would explain it then.
Been having trouble?
Yeah, the whole way.
And you still ain't there yet.
No. There's still a long way to go. Well, I better be going.
Thanks for the meal. But, just don't do anything stupid.
Mark looked at the man, wondering if he knew what Mark was like, and had heard of some of the crazy stunts he'd pulled in the past.
This little feud ain't worth your life.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind.
Mark exited the restaurant and returned to Motherlode. When he was halfway across the parking lot, he realized things were too quiet.
Oh, God damn it!
After just a few steps, Mark realized that the Reaper once again stopped running.
What now?
A quick check of the unit revealed that the fuel tank was empty. That, of course, was impossible, since there had been plenty of fuel in the tank before he'd gone inside, and even a quarter of tank would have lasted 4 to 6 hours, maybe even more. Obviously, someone had drained the fuel tank on purpose. Mark was about to ask himself who might do such a thing, but now it was obvious. The driver of the best beef truck had been shadowing him since Regina, and had sabotaged his reefer at every stop. But how could he have done it so quickly without punching a hole in the tank? Obviously, the people at Best Beef had trained their drivers in guerrilla tactics, and no amount of inspection, precaution, or care was going to stop them from making life difficult for Better Beef drivers. No wonder they can't get anyone to haul for them. Who needs the hassle? Most drivers would just move on to the next company instead of putting up with that sort of crap. Then again, some drivers enjoyed a challenge. Some drivers felt right at home in a good old-fashioned range war. Some drivers you just don't mess around with. Drivers like Mark Dalton, owner-operator.
All right, let's dance, you cheap lowlife bastard. I'm gonna stop you one way or another.
Now that he knew the score, Mark had an idea or two about how to stop Best Beef from getting the better of him and the company he was hauling for. Mark could have gone further, but he decided to stop in Kamloops well before sundown to give himself enough time to make sure he had everything he needed and everything in place. Years ago, before Mark bought Motherlode and headed out onto the open road, he'd worked as a private detective specializing in divorce cases. The money had been pretty good, but the job entailed a lot of nights and weekends videotaping wives and husbands through motel windows so the tapes could later be used in court as evidence or as leverage for a better settlement. Most of the time, it was a simple matter of setting up a camera, making sure he got a few clear images of the party in question, and then packing up and collecting a check. Then one night, the last he ever worked as a private detective, Mark was following the wife of his bank manager. But instead of learning that the bank manager's wife was meeting with some young stud, he discovered that the person in bed with the woman was none other than Mark's own wife, Jenny. That was enough of the detective business for him. After that night, he knew he'd never be able to videotape another cheating spouse as long as he lived. So he quit the business and got a divorce. Then he sold almost everything he had and bought his beloved Motherlode, the only woman in his life who had yet to let him down. There were a few things Mark hung on to, like his set of 1972 hockey cards, his ceramic Batman piggy bank, and his Sony digital handycam. It was an excellent tool for private detectives because it was small, lightweight, and had a night shot feature which made it possible to record images in the dark. The cameras could also be hooked up to sensors, which turned on the recorder only when there was something moving in the frame. That little feature and info-lithium batteries that lasted over 4 hours each made the handycam an invaluable tool for catching someone in the act. Someone like a Best Beef driver vandalizing a Better Beef truck. Mark scouted the truck stop parking lot for the best location and decided on a spot directly behind the fuel station that had everything he needed. To the right was some bushes and a stand of trees where he could set up the camera and tripod without them being seen from the lot. In addition, there was a huge overhead light sitting atop a pole about 50 feet over the truck. Although he could tape in darkness, it was always better to have some light to record by. In the dark, smart lawyers argued that it wasn't their client on the tape, while light removed all shadow of a doubt. Mark set up the camera at dusk, trying to spend as little time in the bushes to avoid suspicion. When a driver did walk by, Mark took a step back from the bushes and pretended to be relieving himself against a tree. When the man was gone, Mark finished setting up the camera, making sure to get all of his rig in the frame. When he was satisfied that he was set up as well as possible under the circumstances, he stepped out from the bushes and pretended to be zipping up his pants, just in case someone had been watching him and wondered what the hell he'd been doing. After that, it was just a matter of waiting for the sun to go down. He headed into the restaurant for a coffee and picked up a copy of the Kamloops Daily News. When he'd finished his second cup of coffee, he was done reading the paper. The sun had fully set behind the mountains to the west. That meant it was time for Mark to take a little tour of the parking lot. As he expected, the big black Best Beef trailer was parked at the opposite end of the lot, tucked in behind a row of tankers. Mark didn't know if the driver was in the cab or not, but it really didn't matter. In fact, it would suit Mark's purposes even better if the driver was in his truck and knew Mark was checking him out. Mark walked around the Best Beef rig twice, taking his time and looking for something he could do as sort of payback for all the grief he'd been given since leaving Regina. He could switch off his reefer, change the set point, maybe even let the air out of his tires. But all of those things could be easily fixed. Mark needed something better, something that would cause the driver some real trouble. He checked the seal on the back of the trailer and saw that it was the thin metal band type that clicked into place and rusted over on trips across the ocean. This type of seal was a lot easier to break than the ceramic button type Better Beef used on their trucks. Button types required a pair of bolt cutters, and drivers didn't usually carry those with them on their runs. Of course, the Best Beef driver just might have bolt cutters in his truck, but Mark was willing to bet he didn't. After a quick look left and right, Mark took out his pocket knife and set about cutting the seal on the Best Beef rig. It took some time, but eventually he was able to hack through the metal and pull the seal from the trailer. His pocket knife was ruined, but thinking of the damage he'd done, the cost of the knife was a small price to pay. First of all, without the proper seal, the load could be turned back by the customer, and that would hurt Best Beef in the pocketbook, right where they'd feel it most. And secondly, a missing seal would probably infuriate the Best Beef driver and provoke him into doing something extreme in retaliation. And that was exactly what Mark wanted. So Mark returned to Motherlode and noted that the reefer unit was running perfectly. Then he climbed into the cab and stretched out in his sleeper, looking forward to a good night's sleep. He was not disappointed. Mark awoke the next morning to utter silence. His plan seemed to have worked, but he had to be sure. He climbed out of his truck and made a quick inspection of the trailer. The seals on the doors were still intact, but the unit had shut down because of all of its oil lines had been cut at some point during the night. He ran into the bushes and checked the tape made during the night. There were various shots of people walking past on their way to the restaurant, and then an extended segment in which a man in black, wearing a Best Beef t-shirt no less, climbed all over his rig, working furiously on the hoses connected to the reefer. The images were so good that Mark could even see the oil spurt and spray as he cut the lines that were under pressure. Mark's grin was from ear to ear. Hopefully the guy's got a change of clothes with him, he thought, as he packed up the camera and loaded it into his truck. When he was all ready to leave, Mark pulled out of the lot without breakfast. On the way to Vancouver, Mark was on his cell phone constantly, first calling Voyage, then asking directory assistance for numbers in both the city of Vancouver and the surrounding suburbs. It would take a couple of hours for Voyage to send a repairman to service the reefer, and it had probably been 2 or 3 hours since the unit had shut down. That meant that Mark needed to keep the entire thing cool until it was up and running again, and the best way to do that was to put the reefer inside another refrigerated container. Luckily for Mark, all of this was happening during the day, when most community arenas were unoccupied and available for rent. When he arrived at the Newton Arena in Surrey, the arena attendant was waiting outside for him.
Hey, you the guy wanting to rent the rink?
Yes, is it still available?
That's $100 an hour.
Mark didn't like the sound of that at all, but he hoped that when he explained the whole story to Woyake, Better Beef would help him with the cost.
$100 is fine.
You got skates?
No. Actually, could you open the big doors at the end of the rink for me, please?
The attendant scratched his head, but after a shrug, he opened the doors for Mark. Mark drove into the arena and parked Motherlode at center ice, where the temperature at ice level was near freezing. It wasn't cold enough to chill the reefer by many degrees, but at least this way, the air creeping into it would be cold, and the deterioration rate of the load, if any, would be reduced. Not a foolproof plan by any means, but the best Mark could come up with on the fly.
You gonna leave that truck there for very long?
Mark explained to the attendant what was going on. Then, when he was done, he asked the man to call him a cab and take him to the Surrey RCMP detachment.
Sure thing.
Mark finally reached the docks by mid-afternoon, the temperature and the set point on his reefer matching perfectly. At the entrance to the yard, Mark saw the Best Beef truck parked by the side of the road, the driver talking heatedly to a couple of constables from the RCMP. The officers waved back at him, one of them holding Mark's tape in his hand. The Best Beef driver waved as well, but his wave consisted of just a single finger.
Serves you right, you dirty bastard.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode featured on the following action-packed titles: Outlanders number 44, Grailstone Gambit; Bloodbond number 12, The Ride for Vengeance; and The Last Gunfighter number 3, Ghost Valley.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.